So go ahead and have your contemplative practice, but don't even dream of stepping outside the box of Christian theology and Aristotle, outside of medieval scholasticism. Because we have the answers. So the only thing experience is good for is validating what we already know to be true by way of divine revelation and its clarification by way of reasoning. So experience is definitely low man on the totem pole. So when someone like Galileo comes along, pops open his 20-power telescope and starts seeing things that are not allowed in the astronomy of Aristotle, then he just must be seeing artifacts of his lenses. Said his medieval scholastic philosophers, who he loathed. They gave him the creeps because he was having such fun. I mean, four centuries from next year, 1609, he came out with a Starry Messenger. He wrote in Italian. He wanted to reach the populace. He wanted to get his clarion call out there where everybody could hear him and just sidestep all this stuffiness, the self-complacency, the arrogance, the condescension of this medieval scholasticism. He just gagged at it. And he despised people in the universities, in philosophy departments above all, that seemed to be so complacent they had all the answers. And he got out there with his little tripod, put up his telescope, and he just started seeing all kinds of naughty things that just shouldn't have been there. There was just no grounds for believing it. Not in the Bible. The Bible gave him no shrift at all. Seeing the real clincher here among his many discoveries was the phases of Venus. That was the most compelling evidence they had at that time, that in fact the earth went around the sun and not vice versa. That was really hard to explain that one away, let alone other things like the sun has pimples. I mean sunspots. You know, according to Aristotle, it's supposed to be perfect. And everything goes around the earth. There shouldn't be any moons going around Jupiter. And so one thing after another, he's discovering that the Bible made no mention of it. And bear in mind, this was supposed to be a complete system. But the Bible made no reference of it. And moreover, the Bible did say the sun rises. In fact, one of the prophets got the sun to stop. You know, if it's not moving in the first place, what exactly does that mean? You know, so it does create some theological problems there. From a physics perspective, it's a complete nightmare. But in any case, Galileo, who is not the most humble fellow of his generation, he insisted that what he was seeing did not consist of artifacts of the lenses. And these hoary old medieval scholastics, I mean, famously, at least by reputation, it is said, they refused to look through the telescope because they knew that if they saw something that was incompatible with or even outside of what they already knew to be true, it couldn't be true. And therefore, it had to be artifacts of the lenses, basically like dropping LSD. Well, I made a discovery. I got it by way of LSD. And yeah, right. It's an artifact of your drug, dummy. And they were saying the same thing about his telescope, that we don't even need to look. If we do, it's just like you dropped us, put some LSD in our Kool-Aid. Why should we look? We already have the answers. We don't need experience. And that is the death knell, not only for science, but it's the death knell for contemplative inquiry. If you don't need experience, then why even bother? Just memorize the book. Get all the answers. You know, write your quiz. Pass your theological exams. Because all that really matters for salvation is having the right answers and being obedient. And so all the wind went out of the sails. And moreover, if these contemplatives should discover anything that was incompatible with the current theology of the time and Aristotle, then they could be burned at the stake. It was not a happy time. It was a time of the Inquisition. Where if like Bruno, you said, oh, I think space is infinite. Oh, I'll burn that guy. And they did. They burned him to death for saying space was infinite. I mean, that seems a bit harsh. Nicholas of Cusa said the same thing, but he got away with it. It's harder to burn a cardinal. Some people had better asbestos underwear. So that was the death knell of contemplative inquiry, when we don't need experience because we know the answers on the basis of authority and reason, and that's it. And so in the words of one Christian historian of contemplative practice within the Roman Catholic Church, he said, Christian contemplative practice died as people just talked about contemplative practice rather than doing it. So something was lost. In the 19th century, something arose. We call it nowadays scientism. Back then, they called it the church scientific. It was also called positivism. It's called scientific materialism. And once again, we have a hierarchy. And now this is prevalent in science today. Arose from around the time of Darwin, the 1860s, and then got really into its heyday, right during the time when evangelical traditions in Christianity were really starting to pound their drums very loudly. It was a time of a lot of evangelism and fundamentalism in the late 19th century. And one of those forms of fundamentalism was called scientism. Taking science now is the one way. So they got totally inspired by Judaism and Christianity, the one way kind of motif. And they said, yeah, it's not Christianity. We have the one way. It's called science. And there's only one source. There is one absolute source of revelation, and that's the physical world. That is, it's the data being presented by nature with a capital N, and nature, by the way, is physical. And so this is the ultimate source. Everything we fundamentally know, or the highest source of knowledge, is physical data coming in from outside. And this means phenomena out there that can be understood in terms of the laws of physics and biology. And finally, everything can be. I've seen this in print just recently, that there are naturalists and there are supernaturalists. That's the way the cookie cutter is cutting these days, the way they're framing it. I see it time and time again. Those religious people who have cotton candy for brains, they believe in the supernatural. And we should start smirking at that point, the supernatural. Whereas we realists, we people who are really know science, we are naturalists. And they say, what do you mean by naturalism? They say, well, what we mean is, like, everything can be explained in terms of the laws of biology and of physics and biology. And then if you push it, you mean everything can already be understood in terms of the laws of physics and biology? And then they start to backpedal a little bit. Well, not yet, but they will be. When? Give us more money, we'll let you know. So a simple thing like consciousness, can that be explained in terms of physics and biology? Not by a long shot. Nobody's got a biological explanation for consciousness. But just give them more time. And that's the article of faith. It's very messianic in its orientation. We don't know yet, but we know we have the right answers. And future generations, instead of being one individual, like the second coming, leaving a whole bunch of left-behinds behind, there will be future generations. It's going to be a pluralism, but future generations, they will prove that what we are sure is right is right. And it's just a matter of time and a lot of money. But everything we know finally comes from nature, and nature is physical. And now within that rubric, that everything boils down to space, time, mass, energy, and then emergent properties of nature as space, time, mass, and energy, within that rubric now, go ahead and exercise your reason. Clarify that with mathematical analysis, with qualitative analysis, make sense of it, but don't step outside the bounds. Because if you do, well, you may be in trouble. You may lose your credentials. Lose your reputation. And a scientist with no reputation is a scientist who doesn't get funding. And a scientist who doesn't get funding, is a scientist out of work. So make sure your reason conforms to the axioms of faith, the articles of faith, that everything just boils down to matter and its emergent properties. And then make sure that all your experience conforms to the above two. And if you have any kind of experience that doesn't, well, ignore it. Discount it. Because literally it doesn't matter. Because the only kind of experience that does matter is matter is experience that conforms to the materialistic axioms of scientism. That kind of experience counts. Any other experience doesn't. I just got a one-on-one when I was studying philosophy of mind at Stanford as a graduate student. And the professor, like virtually everybody in the field, philosophers of mind, is absolutely convinced. I think he never really even raised the question. Absolutely convinced that the mind is simply nothing other than emergent property of the brain or function of the brain. I mean, that wasn't even open for question. And so I simply asked him, if I visualize something, visualize anything, let's say my icon, Bugs Bunny, in the space in front of me, and there's an image, I'm getting it right now, there's my good old Bugs, you know, with this orange carrot and so forth. I said, what's the nature of that image that I'm bringing to mind quite deliberately? I'll look at a painting or a drawing or what have you, visualize Bugs Bunny or an apple, could be anything you like. But I said, what's the nature of that image that I bring to my mind's eye that I can put in front of me or put on top of my head, or I can visualize Bugs Bunny inside my heart? I mean, do whatever you like with it. If you're a pretty good visualizer, you can play around with it. I said, what's the nature of that image of Bugs Bunny? And he turned to me with a straight face and said, it doesn't exist. What? What do you mean? I just told you I'm visualizing Bugs Bunny. I'm seeing an image. Actually, seeing that image can make me smile or crack jokes or hear him say, "What's up, Doc?" What do you mean it doesn't exist? I mean, I can see it with my mind's eye. I generated, I did something, causing conditions to game arise, and I generated that image. What do you mean it doesn't exist? He says, it doesn't exist. I said, why? Because it's not physical. That's the point at which I completely lost interest in the conversation. It was scientific natural revelation completely trumping, smothering into obliteration experience. The experience doesn't count if it's not experience of something physical. This is a mainstream philosopher in a mainstream university. Go ahead and have your experience, but only if and only if it corresponds to the kind of things you're allowed to see. So scientism then trumps empiricism in exactly the same way as medieval scholasticism trumped empiricism 400 years ago. I'm giving you just two sources. There are a lot like this. Neil deGrasse Tyson, director of the Hayden Planetarium, says, as a scientist, I need something better than your eyewitness testimony. Because if even in the court of law, eyewitness testimony is a high form of evidence, in the court of science, it is the lowest form of evidence you could possibly put forth. Seeing something is the worst. That's exactly what the medieval scholastics told Galileo. We already know what's up there. So whatever you see, if it doesn't conform with what we already know is up there, it's the lowest form of evidence. We don't even have to pay attention to it. We will simply ignore it. And actually, this blew my mind when I learned it, into the early 18th century, after Newton had come up with his Principia, this great synthesis of classical physics, even into the early 18th century, in the universities in Europe, they were still teaching, in some cases, Aristotelian physics. The professors in the universities were the last ones to see the light, even though Newton himself taught at Cambridge. The lowest form of evidence, this is a complete stifling of empiricism. You see it, and of course, this is seeing with your eyes, let alone if you see it with your mind. That's below flaky. You know, that he doesn't even need to refer to. You see it with your mind, like, whatever. And then Michael Shermer, which I say with a big chuckle, the skeptic, founding publisher of Skeptic magazine, he says the same thing. Everybody has eyes and ears and a brain that perceives and so on. That's good to know. I think they're all equally unreliable as eyewitnesses. We're very bad at recounting things we think we saw. Unless you're a scientist and this is under controlled experiment and what you're seeing is definitely in accords with the scientific materialism, which then that's fine, and we're skeptics. I think that is just comic. Complete triumph of dogma over experience. Help. William James, the Redeemer, invoke his spirit that passed into in his next life almost a century ago. 1910 he passed away. William James saw with such clarity, so passionately concerned with science, committed to science, one of the great pioneers of Western psychology and neuroscience, such a brilliant philosopher, brilliant scholar of religious experience, so profoundly not dogmatic, and he spoke so well. And apparently he's a pretty nice guy, too. He said, let empiricism once become associated with religion, as hitherto, through some strange misunderstanding, it has been associated with irreligion. And I believe that a new era of religion as well as philosophy will be ready to begin, that is, fuse the spirit of empiricism with religion, and we're going to see a renaissance take place. I fully believe that such an empiricism is a more natural ally than dialectics or mere reason ever were or can be of the religious life. That is, place experience back on the top where it belongs in the first place, the very wellspring of these marvelous contemplative insights, East and West, and we may see a true renaissance, religion starting to recognize its own face once again. William James. from my own perspective, looking at the kind of problems that are besetting humanity nowadays in so many different ways. Obviously, there's no one quick fix. There's no silver bullet. But I do believe the contemplative traditions of the world have something unique and of tremendous value to offer, and that we're in urgent need of a contemplative renaissance. In Buddhism, Buddhism, like any other tradition, become dogmatic, fundamentalist, closed-minded, stuffy. It happens. I've met quite a number of religious fundamentalists within the Buddhist fold, more than I can count in the Christian. I've met Jews. I know of Muslims and so forth. All such dogmatism is just the toxic for true contemplative inquiry. But the possibility of having a renaissance in this area that would be so complementary to science, how could this occur through possibly a synthesis of various very rigorous first-person methodologies, as we've seen from these various practices set forth in the Christian and the Buddhist? I would hasten to add you'll find comparable ones in the Jewish and the Vedanta, in the Taoist. So I wasn't just picking out two good ones and throwing all the other ones away, just focusing for the sake of time, since we're almost out, of two great traditions with noble heritages. Synthesize these rigorous first-person methodologies that I've just alluded to briefly with the very insightful third-person methodologies. And then this, through this interreligious means of experientially investigating essential features, let there be an experiential investigation of essential features of human existence and potentials of consciousness. Bring together the third person and the first person, and again, not just one religious tradition, but multiple ones. And in terms of the people, I mean, there's a strategy, but in terms of the people, find or cultivate or train accomplished contemplatives who really have professional training, like the monks on Mount Athos, Tibetan yogis in Eastern Tibet nowadays, and from different traditions. This is really a major feature of the mission statement for the Santa Barbara Institute. Bring them together, get them in the same room or the same contemplative observatory from different traditions, different worldviews, and let them then interface amongst themselves to work together as experts, as professionals, to sift out what are the definitive meanings, what are the provisional meanings, what are the timeless truths, what are the local, the localized, contingent truths amongst the contemplative traditions. And then let them interface with very accomplished contemplative scientists, cognitive neuroscientists, psychologists, philosophers of mind, cross-pollinate. Let them all illuminate each other. And I think we could simultaneously see what I've called the first revolution in the mind sciences, for which it's high time, we've been waiting long enough, with a true renaissance in the contemplative domain, a rejuvenation of them all together, pluralistically. And I think the time is getting pretty ripe. I'm seeing it accelerating now from just the last few years. Questions being raised, invitations I've never received before. This year, just two examples, Caltech and MIT. I've never spoken at Caltech or MIT before. But there are invitations. What are you going to do? You know? And a bunch of other places. And of course, it's not just me. I'm just one representative. But it's an opening up, especially among the younger generation of scientists. Just kind of tired, just like Galileo and his generation, just frankly bored with a system that has all the answers and no questions, medieval scholasticism. And young people nowadays, starting out in their doctorate programs in cognitive neuroscience and psychology, philosophy of mind, religious studies. Just today, I think it was this morning, an inquiry from a graduate student at Stanford saying, I'm in religious studies, I'm so fascinated by this interface, tell me more about the Shamatha Project. Another one was a cognitive scientist in Germany. No, another one was like a psychologist in Canada. They're coming with the same questions. But from religious studies, psychology, philosophy, cognitive neuroscience, it's young people, it's also people more of my generation. Unprecedented opening. Quite a thrilling time to be alive. Let's stay alive. See what happens. But I think there are paths to perfection here. And commonalities may be illuminating the deepest aspects of reality that can be illuminated and that are the most significant for finding the greatest sense of well-being and fulfillment. It's a strong hunch. I bet my life and all my life on that one. So that's it for tonight.